Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by BlackRifleCoffee.com.
Welcome to Drinking Bros. Robert Patrick is on the show today.
When you clapped your hands like that, all the lights in my dealership went on and off and on.
You still got those plugged in.
Yeah, you still got the clappers.
Clap on.
Clap off, yeah.
It's a pleasure to have you guys here. Welcome to beautiful Santa Clarita, California.
Gorgeous. Look, we've been to a few Harley dealerships.
I was just saying, this is one of the nicest
Thank
ones I've been
much.
In.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You've really got a decoration style.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I give the credit to all my guys, Danny Vartanian, my general manager, Jesse Mancillas, marketing, Kennedy. We've been working really hard on this place. When we bought it, it was an existing dealership here. And we put a lot of sweat equity into this to spruce it up for the citizens of Santa Clarita, California.
Yeah, it's hard to get a Harley dealership, a franchise, right?
It's not easy.
No.
Yeah,
I get one of my best friends from college. His dad owns two. That was his lifelong dream, was to own a Harley dealership. But I think he said his process was something close to like 14 years.
Well, I mean,
because he had to get vetted and somebody had to...
I don't know exactly what the vetting process is, but I do know that it's been a dream of mine for as long as I can remember.
It wasn't that long ago, though, and you could speak to this much better than me, but Harley's had a waiting list just to get one.
Yeah.
Like in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, the 70s, the 80s and the 90s was probably the big years where you did have to wait for a Harley. You had to wait.
You couldn't
just walk in.
Yeah, and now the business has evolved where it's, you know, we've got the best bikes we've ever been building, and you don't have to wait.
Yeah, exactly.
So come on down.
When did your love of motorcycles begin? Because look, to own your own dealership, that's saying, hey, this is a lifestyle. This is my lifestyle.
Yeah. When I was in high school, junior high, elementary school, mini bikes, dirt bikes, that kind of thing, a little bit, never owned one myself, but friends. I think when I was 19, 20 some odd, I got a Yamaha Midnight Special because it looked like a Harley and it was cheap.
Yeah.
It was black with gold trim. And I started riding that around and, back in Ohio, and then
we're out in Ohio.
I was living in outside of Cleveland for a while, Westlake, Ohio, that was the first bike I bought. But I always wanted a Harley, and I did a movie after Terminator 2 where I rode a Harley.
Yeah.
And it was right then that I went out and bought a used Harley.
That's awesome.
So that was 1991 or 92.
Yeah.
When I bought that Harley. It was the first one. I didn't buy my first brand new Harley until a couple years later, and I bought it from Oliver Shoku, who's my business partner in this. He's the owner of Glendale Harley Davidson.
Really?
Which is the home of the Love Ride, which became the charitable thing that I got involved with my riding. And he sold me my first bike, a 94 Fat Boy that looked just like the one Arnold rode in Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
speaking of Arnold, obviously, that had to have been your breakthrough as Terminator 2.
Biggest thing I've ever done in my life. Biggest movie. That character has given me my entire career. You know, I'm almost, I'm definitely in my 30th year of acting. And probably about 32, 33 years by now. It broke everything wide open for me, and I'm still riding that wave.
When you got that, did you know that it was, like, did they tell you a lot of information, or was it kind of like a, hey, we think, you know, you read for a role, like, did you know that it was an Arnold picture? Did you know anything about it?
Well, I got a call from my agent saying, you got to go meet on Terminator 2. They're looking for an intense presence. That's all we can tell you. So I went, and I was, you know, wearing black jeans, a black T-shirt, and a black motorcycle jacket. It's pretty much the way I bombed around Hollywood at the time. I was living in a dive apartment with my my girlfriend, and we had just gotten engaged. And I went to this thing, and my look kind of caught Mally Finn. I did some eye work with her when she turned around, and she kind of said, "Whatever you're doing now, I like that." I went and worked with a guy named Steve Quayle. I just did this whole improvisational ad lib audition where I tried to be sense aware, and I slowed everything down. I looked to the predators and started thinking, what's a predator look like, and just what's an intense, you know, and just went for it. And they recorded it, and James Cameron watched it that night. And the next day I got a call saying they want you to come back and do some more. They really responded to it.
Wow.
I was just following my instincts.
Sure.
But I knew I was on to something because I just, you know, it's like one of those things where synchronicity, where the universe was aligned just right. Everything was perfect. And
right.
My instincts were right. And I just kept going with it. It's neat to think back on that now, that I was that fearless to kind of go creatively, because it was unique. And essentially everything you see that I did in the movie was what I did at that audition.
Yeah, because usually really? At an audition, you kind of get afraid to take big choices like that.
Yeah.
But it's also what separates you from everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've got to be bold and make moves like that. I mean, again, I was, you know, that was totally just off my gut reaction to what they had sent, not having read the script. Once I read it,
yeah.
Then I went full bore with it. And once I really started discussing with James Cameron, when he was in the room and he was filming me, then we went crazy. I started thinking about American Indians, what it would be like to be sense-aware, how you would be, and just slowing everything down and the way you would look around and just be as little presence as possible, but as intense as possible. It's a neat thing to think about. We actually discussed the AI, the T-1000, the artificial intelligence. Where would they go for programming for something like that? To the natural order.
A hunter.
To the natural world, right?
Right.
Where would you go? Who are the best hunters in nature? Mountain lions.
Wolves.
Yeah.
Wolves. Cats. Eagles. You know. And how do they? And so that's what we used, and we said that would be what would be the software for this artificial intelligence. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Super cool. What? Yeah, where does it go from there? Now you get the script, you get on production.
Yeah, you well.
Were you intimidated at all with Arnold?
I wasn't intimidated until I read the script, because at this point all I knew was they were looking for something they knew. They were looking for something specific, but I didn't know how big the role was going to be.
Yeah, then you realize you're in the whole fucking movie.
And so then it's like that gulp moment where you're walking up and the bases are loaded, and you got two outs and it's a 3-2 count.
Bottom of the ninth. Yeah.
And the pressure. You all of a sudden and it's how you're going to do with the pressure. So I had to do. I read the script, and I couldn't believe it when I read it. It took me like 5 hours to read it. I kept visualizing, holy shit, I'm the fucking T-1000. I'm the bad guy. Oh my god, how the fuck did I get here? You know what I'm saying? This is unbelievable. So it's one of those moments where you have to buff yourself up to, I am worthy. Because you start to think like, oh God, I'm not worthy of this. I can't do this. Self-doubt starts creeping in, all that kind of stuff, those fears. So I had to get over that. It took me a while. And I walked into Cameron's office. I walked into James Cameron's office.
Yeah.
And I popped the script down on his desk and I said, I can do this. And he took his glasses off and he looked up at me and he goes, that's why you're here.
Really?
That's how it went down.
Because he's an intense dude himself.
He's intense. I have to admit, the entire time I did the movie, there was a certain amount of pressure that I felt. There was a couple times that I went to him, even after I'd gotten it, and I'd worked my ass off, and I trained for 4 months for it with this Uzi Gal, this Israeli Special Force Commando. And even though I had trained like an athlete, and was in superior condition, the best I'd ever been in, I still wasn't quite sure what I was doing was enough. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You're relying on a lot of things that aren't there. There was a lot of special effects that I had to visualize and conceptualize.
But there were other pieces that you added to it that became so iconic, like to this day, I think the most iconic run ever is your run.
Right.
Like that's the only anything in America that you could say, run like the T-1000, and that's what they do. And I'm sure that came from you.
It came from me, but I stole it from, I think it was Ben Foster was the sprinter at the time. I mean, I went and looked at sprinters and how do they move and how do they
like
run.
Where nothing is affecting him.
Yeah, and so the whole theory behind the T-1000 is constant movement forward. So if you go back and look at the film, everything from the body posture to the way I moved to the way I started walking, it was never a side-to-side. It was a constant forward motion. The straightest distance between two points is a straight line. You know, that kind of a theory. So everything was, how do I project my image going forward, relentless? So when you look at sprinters are looking at something down there, and they're focused on that, and they haul ass after it. So it's the same thing I did with the mini bike.
Yeah.
It's like I put a little piece of, tape on the back of everything that I was chasing, wherever they would have the cameras, it'd always be a piece of tape that I was running at. And then you would add in, like, I'm going to try not to blink.
Right. Which is hard, sprinting.
I'm going to breathe through my nose.
So you're just locked.
I'm going to clench my jaw and keep my mouth shut and make it look as if this is effortless. So, and no wasted motion, right? So all that was in it, and that's really the performance is that.
No, now that you're talking about it, I'm visualizing it, especially like every time that you were going through a crowd after John, you never went side to side.
Yeah,
it was always just leaning forward, straight line.
And again, I can't take all the credit for that because James and I, Cameron, discussed this. I mean, we were very collaborative. In the pulling out the performance of the T-1000, it had to have things that you could plug into. The run had to be a constant run. You can't run one way. You can't run one way one day and not run the same way the next day. The walk had to be consistent. Had to be the same walk every time. So that is the performance. It's not the monologues I didn't do. You know what
right.
I mean? It's that, and I think that's why it's iconic now.
Well, the strangest thing to me is when I look back at that film, I remember you. Like to me, you made that movie, and it's like all I think about is that straight running, turning into liquid. Like that's what I remember. But that's the most iconic scene to me in
Terminator 2.
It
was also like you went to from Arnold being the evil one previously, and now he's good, and now this just took evil to a whole new level.
Oh, yeah. This guy doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
This guy doesn't talk.
And, oh, shit, this is more advanced from what we just saw.
This guy, oh, my God, he just walked out of fire.
Yeah.
You know, that's the jaw dropper is the
There's another question. Like, this was one of the first movies that really started pushing the envelope of CGI.
Well, according to Steve Spaz Williams, who worked at ILM and came up with, he's the one that put me in three-dimension in the computer. And him and Mark Dupay out of Industrial Light and Magic, they put me on a Lazy Susan. I had on a pair of brief swimming trunks and a skull cap. So I'm essentially nude. They painted a three-inch box squares all around my body and then filmed me walking and running. And that was the first motion capture in the history of film.
Really?
That was the invention of motion capture.
Wow.
So now you see these guys wearing these things with the little
ping-pong balls.
All over them and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of the same thing, but that's where it was. That's where they came up with it, the conception of it.
What was it like working with Arnold? Was
he
cool?
He's a great guy, yeah.
Is he?
Yeah. You know, everybody gave me a lot of distance while I was making the movie, and I wanted distance because I didn't want to really get to know anybody, and I had, like, this mental checklist, like an athlete, anybody. This is what I got to do. This is what I got to think about. This is my game plan for today. This is what I got to be. And I would stay kind of close to myself.
Did you guys party afterwards at all?
We partied during Christmas. We had a Christmas break. We had a Christmas party. And then when the movie was over, there was a big party. We were all there.
What was principal timeline? 6 months?
I feel like we filmed for 7 months.
Wow. That's a long time.
I feel like it was 7 months and about 3 or 4 months worth of prep that I wrote a journal to James Cameron of what I was feeling as a T-1000. The training I did for this thing was, it was Navy SEAL-esque. I mean, it's nothing's as tough as being a Navy SEAL. I'm not trying to squeeze in on their fame, but I'm saying it was Israeli Special Forces Commando. You know, I was down at the beach, soaking in the power of the ocean, and then he would tap me on the shoulders, and I would go run for a couple miles, and I'd be running out into the water carrying sandbags with, backpacks and sit-ups in the water, going under, you know, just crazy stuff. The guy just beat the living hell out of me. But it all paid off. You know, 4 months later, I literally felt like I could kick anybody's ass. I wasn't afraid of anybody. I thought I could run through a fucking wall. And I believed it. I was gullible enough to believe it, you know.
Where did you see it opening night?
James Cameron. Outside of the premiere.
Yeah, outside of the premiere.
Opening night.
Did you go? Did you sneak in?
Yeah, he got me 20 tickets. I lived at Hollywood Tower at Franklin and Argyle with my bride because we got married by then. And I invited 20-some-odd friends. Xander Berkeley was there who played the Voights. Was it the Voights? John Connor's step-parents.
Yeah.
He's the one that gets the milk carton.
Yep. Yes.
He was there. Jason Clark, a friend of mine, he was the first AD. He's a huge producer now.
Yeah, he's
not
massive.
The actor, but the producer, Jason Clark. He was there. Bunch of other people were there that, you know, guys I'd done plays with and stuff. And we had 20 tickets. We went to the Cinerama Dome.
Ah, it's the best. We were just there, the other night.
We walked down from my apartment at Franklin and Argyle, walked down there, walked in, an anonymous guy. By the time the movie was over, my life had changed. Right there on the spot.
Was everybody bombarding you for pictures and autographs and stuff?
Oh, my God, you're that guy. It was that thing.
How are you getting pictures back then? There's no camera phones.
People are slightly intimidated, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's an intense role, so they were, you know, slightly intimidated by it, you know?
Well, it was such a hailed movie, too. Nobody was upset with it. And then it set records for years.
It's still around. I mean, this movie just keeps going on and on, and I am so proud to have been a part of something so big.
Right.
It's amazing. And, you know, really appreciative of the fans. Some of the interesting little anecdotes I'll give you since we're sitting in my Harley-Davidson dealership.
Yeah.
Billy Idol was going to be the T-1000.
You're kidding.
I am not.
Why Billy Idol?
I can't
Idol?
See that at
no,
all.
No, no.
Billy Idol was going to play the part. And he got in a motorcycle accident riding a Harley-Davidson.
No shit.
And he injured a leg where he couldn't run and be physical. And James Cameron had to cast somebody. So he had a second chance to cast the role. So he decided to try to go with an unknown. Think about it. You got no preconceived notion of this guy. You've never Right. seen this guy in your life unless you've seen some obscure little B movies that I did for Roger Corman. Essentially, I'm completely anonymous.
Yeah.
And you cast him in this role.
As the most evil thing.
You're going to believe it. You know, so it's not like, if I throw a name out, it's not disparaging. It's, you know, I'm not Bruce Willis trying to be the T-1000. It's a complete unknown guy.
Yeah.
Is the T-1000. Oh my God, I buy that reality. I buy the movie. I believe it. It's another reason why I think maybe that character has such a indelible impression on people.
Yeah, and speaking of Bruce Willis, you did Die Hard 2, right?
Yeah, that was as a matter of fact, that was in the theaters when James was thinking about casting me, and he went to see what I looked like up on the big screen, and it was part of my screen test, kind of.
How was Bruce to work with?
Oh, Bruce was a sweetheart. He was a great guy. That was my first studio movie. I had done a bunch of Roger Corman films. I started in B movies. I could do the action, even though I wasn't a real stunt guy. I could do it because I played football and baseball when I was growing up. I wasn't afraid of anything. And they just put me in lead movie after lead movie after lead movie. So it really was my film school. I learned how to be an actor for Roger Corman. And by the time I got to Bruce, I kind of knew what I was doing a little bit better.
Right.
And Oh, he was fantastic to work with. He's a great guy. To this day, I think he's, you know, just fantastic. I'd love to work with him again.
Roger Corman's one of those guys who, he started a lot of people, and
sure,
people don't know how many people he truly started. Didn't he give, Ron Howard his first?
You're exactly right.
Directing credit, yeah.
Ron Howard wanted to direct, and Roger said, you can direct, but you also got to be in it, and gave him the opportunity.
Wow.
So,
because he was coming off of Happy Days, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Peter Bogdanovich. Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
These guys all started with Roger Corman. Jack Nicholson.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dennis Hopper. Well, Dennis did some movies with it. I think Dennis got to start somewhere else. But if you really check into the people that went through the Roger Corman Film School, and I am so lucky that I had a friend that was working for Roger Corman that told me they were looking for a psychotic biker for this movie. And he told me about it. I went down and auditioned, and I got the role, and just worked my ass off, man.
Yeah.
They cast me in another one and another one and another one.
The crazy phone calls you get after this hits theaters.
Oh, Terminator 2?
Yeah.
This is before social media and before all that, so... You know, I don't think that many people had my phone number.
Oh, really?
To be honest with you. I heard from some childhood friends. I moved around so much when I was a kid. I've lived in like 6 different cities. I was born in Atlanta, Boston, Dayton, Detroit, and Cleveland, all those places before I was 18. I heard from some people who were really proud of me, some people that had wondered what had happened to me after high school. You know, I didn't amount to much. Everybody's kind of wondering where I was. Oh, they heard I was off in Hollywood trying to make it in the movie business. You know, some people thought for sure, well, yeah, he's probably doing porn and a lot of drugs or something. You know, I think we showed him a little bit. So.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Yeah, because you've worked steady for a long time. I mean, you're the definition of a working actor. We had Max Martini on the show.
Max is fantastic.
Yeah, and you just starred in his movie as well, Sergeant Will Gardner.
And I think that was his first directorial. I think he's directing another one. Yeah. Max and I worked together on The Unit.
Yep.
We rode motorcycles together. He used to be a part of my motorcycle club, the Boost Fighters Motorcycle Club. He's no longer an active member. We did a lot of USO tours together. He has a very sincere love for the American
Veteran
Armed Forces. And
so do you as well. You've done a ton of stuff.
This is kind of how we all connected.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is. I have, and mine comes from my grandfather, who was a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. He fought World War I, World War II, Korea, and he was still active in 1963 when he died and the Vietnam War was going. So his grave marker looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I bet.
This Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Patrick served this country in World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
That's amazing.
Pretty badass.
Yeah, how do you beat that?
You don't.
That's my grandfather. It's interesting that you bring this up because I know you served in... when I was going to high school, it was the Vietnam War, which was a different war entirely for us as a nation, because you guys are too young, but I watched that war on TV in black and white. And it was when the media really started to present it in a certain way that spurned that whole culture that wanted to stop the war, and the war was bad and wanted to end the war. There was, when I was in high school, there was such a patina of stink, really, on the Vietnam War vet, because they were portrayed to be child killers, baby killers, and
right.
You know, they came back and people spit on them. They didn't welcome them home. That going into the service didn't look very attractive to me. You know, once I graduated high school,
sure.
It wasn't. And I come from a family that dates all the way back to the Revolutionary War, that has fought for this country since. And I sort of feel bad about that in a way, guilty that I didn't really look at the armed forces as a possible career choice. But it was influenced by that. And I, you know, now I find myself through Harley Davidson, through riding across the country and going and doing Rolling Thunder, and riding with veterans of the Vietnam War and hearing their stories, that I really feel such gratitude. And I want to make sure they know.
Because you've been doing a lot. You've done things with Patriot Guard, and you know, you're really heavily involved in Rolling Thunder. How's that going?
Well, Rolling Thunder is really where I got my education, and my brothers, my Vietnam vet brothers that I hold very dear to my heart, that I understand their experience, and I found out that, you know, they never lost a battle. They never lost a gunfight. Never.
Yeah.
And they were treated with such disrespect when they came back to this country. So Rolling Thunder is my way of showing my love and support for them. And it's a lot different than the way the media portrayed it back in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up.
Yeah, you know, now it's such a different time where, you know, I see people stop Jared all the time and say, hey, thank you for your service.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the way it should have been for those guys coming back from Vietnam, but it wasn't. It was not,
because of the way the media portrayed it.
Well, I think so.
Yeah, I think so too.
It was what it was. I mean,
but it was misplaced anger. At the end of the day, you know, why don't you treat your politicians, your elected officials like that? They're the ones that sent us over there.
Yeah, you know, we all know the history
of how
we got.
You're in a draft. You got guys that didn't even have a choice.
These poor guys went over because they had to.
Yeah.
And you can't even show them the respect to at least thank them for their service.
I didn't get a choice. I got a letter in the mail that said, here, report.
Yeah. And now we've got an all-volunteer army. Yeah. You know, I only bring that up because it was, it's my way of kind of thinking back. Why didn't I really think about the armed forces when I was graduating high school? I think it was really about that. That's me being
looking back on it. Let me ask you this, because we've had this discussion on the show a few times regarding the media. Was it as bad back then as it is now?
Well,
because you only had three channels?
It just
at that point?
But channels. That's when they figured out that they had that power.
Yeah, that control. And I wonder, because you know, you've lived through all of it now at this point.
Right.
Was it just as bad, or do you think today has gotten worse?
Well, I think communication is so advanced now, and you know, I think it's all been turned completely upside down. I mean, it's just crazy how fast something happens in the world, and it's everybody in the world knows it.
Information, yeah.
It's just so amazing now. It's a little terrifying.
Yeah.
How do you get lost? How can you get lost anymore? You can't. You can't get lost. You know? We are so overwhelmed with the amount of information we have access to. It's hard to unplug. It's hard not to be influenced by somebody. And what we do have to do is look at who is behind these big engines that are giving us the information, and are they editing
you
the information?
You have to remind yourself that this is these are businesses too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way that they succeed is to get you to click on them.
Right.
Okay, so they've realized in the last year that they could pretty much do whatever they want to get you to click on them, and then if it's true, it's all right. If it's not true, we'll say something about it later.
Yeah, we won't even apologize for it.
No,
That's the thing that scares me as a citizen, is to realize that somebody can just make a claim about me, throw it out there, and I've now got to defend myself in the court of public opinion. When I used to be in a justice system where you were guilty, you were innocent until proven guilty, and now you can be tried in the court of public opinion, and your life can be ruined forever.
Yeah, and it's this mob mentality that exists. But I wondered if it was the same back then, because look, you see the protests, in today's world, for whatever people are protesting over.
Right, right.
Obviously, we had the protests in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
Over the war and civil rights and all that stuff. Has it really changed that much, or is it just the social media aspect of it?
You know, sitting back on it, looking at it, and I was a younger man back then. I mean, I was a young boy back then with a lot of that stuff. And the 60s was a very, decade of a lot of protests and injustice, and things got fixed through the protests and whatnot. But I wonder if the the people that are protesting now are trying to live in the 60s by carrying on that tradition of, wow, protesting's cool, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go protest. You know, that's what they did back in the 60s, you know, and look what, but they did cause change and effect, you know, through it. So, but I wonder if it's sort of like a carryover. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, huh, all right, yeah.
I look at it the same way, too, where I look back. My wife and I were watching, you know, one of those CNN, like, the year 1960s, you know? Yeah. And then when we looked at it, we were like, oh, shit. It almost looks like the same thing.
Same thing now, that's
going on
now. I mean, you and I watched that Netflix series in the 90s.
Yeah.
And, like, when you see how hard CNN was going after the Clintons when they were in the White House, it was like, wait, this is the same.
Yeah, it is the same.
It just changed characters.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
It's good for ratings.
That's exactly. Yeah. All of this is good for ratings.
It's good for ratings. And I'm a part of that media world. I mean, I get it, but it's just amazing. I just hate to see people that are innocent being convicted in the court of public opinion before they even have a chance to defend themselves.
Yeah.
I don't think that's right. Have you guys ever sat on a jury?
I've been involved in a few court proceedings as a bailiff, so that and it's crazy. People that have never been involved in like a criminal case, like when you see how it actually is, it's eye-opening.
It's an interesting experience. I mean, it's the one thing that's in our Constitution twice that you get to have a appearance in court and there's a jury of your peers. Jury duty is a privilege that we have. That we get to go and serve and hopefully find this person innocent of what they're being
accused of.
Thank you. And I sat on a murder trial, and it's astounding to go and do your part and be a part of it. It's a neat thing. I like jury duty.
Were you famous at the time?
Yes.
How is that? How is that
the
being?
The judge was excited to have the T-1000 in his courtroom. As a matter of fact, and you guys, you'll appreciate funny. This. This is 2000, this is just a couple years ago. It's the last, he literally said to everybody, unless you're going to Afghanistan or Iraq, you have no excuse to not be on this jury if you're selected. And my hand went up. And I said, I am scheduled to go on a USO tour in a week and a half. And I was already on the...
to Afghanistan.
And I literally said, to Afghanistan. And he just looked at me and said, we'll be done before you go. And I went, okay. I was sort of disappointed, like, I made it to this jury.
Yeah, yeah.
Because usually what happens is they go, I don't want
yeah,
that
you
guy.
Get,
he's
you
gonna
get
influence everybody. He's a celebrity.
Yeah. So what happened? You
stayed on the jury. I was on it. Are you allowed to talk about what you did on a jury?
Yeah, once it's over.
This poor young guy was convicted, but he was guilty.
He was guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
was it a murder?
Yeah, and it was gang related.
Oh. Did you have, once seeing this process work, did you get frustrated with some of the nonsense?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest thing for me, is going through that is like, it opens your eyes of, I hope to God I never have to do this, because there is a lot of bullshit that we have put into this process that's like, wait, I'm sorry, what?
But it is still, but going back to what we were talking about with communication and everything, it's still the greatest system. There's no other country in the world. Usually, you're guilty.
Yeah.
Now prove you're not guilty. We assume you're innocent. So we're going to have to prove that you're guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt. That's a pretty unique setup.
It is. I'm frustrated with like chain of custody
things.
It's like you have a video of the guy doing it, but we can't show it to you because we accidentally we didn't have it in a baggie.
We didn't follow the protocol.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you're like, wait a minute.
It was tampered.
Wait a minute. There's a video of the guy committing this crime, but we can't use it. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. What?
Come again right there. We know the guy did it, but we have to pretend we don't because the evidence wasn't submitted properly.
Yeah.
Do that again?
That's kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Did you get $25 a day?
I can't remember. They gave me something, you know. I've got jury duty coming up in a week and a half.
You're kidding.
Great. I swear to God, I get to go back.
You seem excited about it.
I think it's the coolest thing in the world.
It is super
jury
interesting.
Cool.
If you've ever been inside a criminal case, like, I mean, it is like, and I'm sure it's like A Few Good Men. Like, lawyers are fired up. They're yelling at people on the stand. Like, they're getting, like, it is a giant act.
Look, you pay all that money for a reason, so they got to put on a show.
It's badass, man. You watch these guys, and they're super smart. These attorneys,
and they're looping people in an examination to get them emotional, and then they hit them with a heart.
it's great, especially where I live in L.A. I go downtown, and I get the hardcore stuff. So it's fascinating to me.
Yeah,
human
this
beings
criminal-
are fascinating to me. Obviously, that's why I'm an actor, because I love to study people and try to, you know, portray them, the aspects of their personality.
Is this another criminal case that you're going in?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. That's
interesting.
Might, you know, now I've done it once, I guess maybe I'm the guy to do it again.
You're the guy.
Maybe
they need
maybe
to
they
use this as
out.
A campaign. Like,
yeah, exactly. Nobody wants to do jury duty. He's not using
it as an excuse, and neither can you.
Yeah. You know what? My brother, Richard Patrick, who is the lead singer and the creator of the band Filter, he used to be the guitarist for Nine Inch Nails.
Wait, that's your brother?
Yeah, Richard Patrick, yeah. He just got banned in El Paso.
Why? Oh, he's from El Paso.
El Paso, the concert was canceled.
Why?
He's very political, and he was telling the people that were the venue. He asked the video guy. He said, "Can we flip the flag upside down and show it in distress? And I'm gonna do some stuff to distress the flag, and because we're in a state of." Distress. The country's in a state of distress because of the current administration. That was his point of view. It was First Amendment right.
Sure.
And the venue guy said, "No fucking way. Get the fuck out of here."
Yeah, yeah.
And they
kicked
him out. And his concert got canceled. And it's interesting. But why did I bring him up? I brought him up. Oh, because he shares the view that jury duty is cool. He likes it.
He likes it too. He's been on it.
So does my wife. She's done it too.
Really?
It's an interesting thing. I don't know. I find it fascinating. You can stay and do your job.
We need an LA County PSA with him about jury.
Oh, yeah.
Go to jury duty.
Are you kidding me?
It's a cool thing, man. It's your civic duty.
What's the coolest?
Kennedy, how many times have you been on?
One time.
Thank you.
One time, but what? You said but. There's always a but.
I didn't go through. Like,
you don't get selected.
You didn't get selected, yeah.
It's the beard.
Yeah.
Shave the beard.
You look too sketch. Way too sketchy for a jury.
My marketing guy.
Yeah.
Back.
What's the coolest thing you've gotten to do from being a celebrity? You ever gone to the White House?
I've taken a tour of the White House.
Who was in office at the time?
2 years ago, President Trump.
That's great.
I did not get to meet him. I almost got to meet him, which was interesting. You know, I've campaigned for people over the years. I got to go to the White House in the inauguration for Bill Clinton back in the day.
I would imagine Trump has a photo of you from Terminator 2 somewhere that he hangs out.
I bet he's a huge fan.
I would like to think so. I would like to think so. I hope he does. That'd be cool.
Do you still look at it like an honor to go to the White House?
The T-1000 with a spray tan. Maybe. It'd be cool.
You look at it like it's an honor to go to the White House, right?
I think whoever is the commander-in-chief, I think you got to show him the utmost respect.
Same.
I take the same position that the military takes. You know, whoever's the commander-in-chief, he's the guy.
Yep.
Or gal, if that happens.
You think it'll happen?
Oh, most probably in my lifetime.
That's
sure.
What I think, too.
And I'm 60, so
I think
I got another 20 years.
I think after this re-election, we'll see a woman going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I do too.
It's interesting. I mean, politics is such a big topic, and it can really cause problems if you, you know.
Especially in Hollywood.
Yeah. And that's you know, I don't know why that is, to be honest with you. Why is that such a big thing here?
I don't get it either.
Community?
I don't get it.
I think maybe because of... communication in the media. I mean, it's, you know, it's all kind of controlled out of here, I guess.
Yeah.
New York and Hollywood.
And most of the fundraisers and all that stuff, like, you know, when I lived here, it was, you could tell who was coming up and who they were grooming as far as these candidates go. And, you know, we said in our show, I don't know, 6 months ago, I'd gotten, you know, I still get the emails and I'm on those mailers of like, hey, come meet Kamala Harris for, for some brunch, because they're essentially testing her to see how much money she can raise and
picking
and all
the
that
candidate.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They, you know, they want a candidate that's going to have a TV queue, someone that people are going to like.
Yeah.
Someone that looks, you know, looks like the image of what a president should look like. You know, all that goes into the picking of the candidate, I would imagine, which is a shame because it should really be based on policy. You know, what really is their platform? What are they going to do? What are their values? You know, that kind of thing. But I think there's so much of the image thing, and that probably goes back to, probably started with President Kennedy, did it not?
Yeah, I would think so. He was the first one that, you know, look, I wasn't alive, but as far as the media coverage goes, you were? Barely.
No,
just
no,
a couple summers.
Alive,
a couple.
I'm 60, so I remember the day he got...
killed?
I don't think I remember the day he got killed. The day he was buried. I was home sick from school. I watched that. I think I saw the Lee Harvey Oswald shooting, too.
Really?
Live on TV.
On live?
Yeah.
How was that?
I think I was home. I seem to, if it's in my memory, I don't know if, in fact, I did. It feels like I saw that.
Because mine was, for my generation, was the shuttle that exploded.
Oh, God. The Challenger.
Challenger. So I was in school, and they'd wheeled in a TV for all of us to watch it, and then, you know.
You served this country.
I did.
You volunteered.
Yeah, he did.
You went.
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Well, my dad was in the Navy for 29 years. He retired. Well, I'd been in for almost 10 years by the time he retired. But, you know, that was how we were growing up. His dad was in the Navy, too, and I was fascinated with Charlie Sheen and Navy SEALs.
That's cool.
Yeah. I remember.
You knew you wanted to be a Navy SEAL.
I wanted to do something cool.
He was not a Navy SEAL.
Yeah, my dad.
He wanted to be.
Yeah, did you? Did you want to be? That's a
game. Yeah. I mean, if you look at our yearbook from back in the day, I think I was in eighth grade. I said I wanted to be a SEAL at Dev Group.
But see, that's so cool because what I was mentioning, like in the 70s, because of the way our guys were coming home and the way they were mistreated, by the time it was time for him to go, post 9/11, I would imagine. You know, you were beyond that, and you were looking at duty to your country and going to serve your country because your family had done that.
I had lived on base when 9/11 happened, so like...
you were already on base.
I wasn't in the military, but we lived on base.
Oh, you lived on base.
I was 16.
Absolutely.
So we get picked up at... They close the school at 11 o'clock because we're on the West Coast.
Sure.
At around 11 o'clock, and we hit the freeway and sat in line for 10 hours to get on.
Wow.
Because they locked the base down, and then when they finally started letting people back on, it was full search, full dogs, every vehicle, like everything. And we just sat in that car for a good 10 hours. It was gnarly. And then I did one more year of school and then went over. Now, when I was in basic training, I was almost done with it, and we were at the time where you're not, you know, in this structured course. You're kind of cleaning up the barracks and everything like that. The instructor came in and did the same thing, wheeled a TV in, plugged it in, and said, "We're invading Iraq. Get ready to go."
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. You know, I've worked with this actor, Jake McLaughlin. I don't know if you know him. He was in... I can't think of the name of the movie with Tommy Lee Jones. Kennedy will look that up for me. Jake McLaughlin. I did a movie with him called Safe House. Anyway, Jake, growing
up... Safe House is a great movie.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Northern California grew up, and 9/11 happened. He left right from high school and went and enlisted in the Army and was on the tip of the spear of the invasion of Iraq. Now he's an actor. He's a great guy. You should have him on your
podcast. I would love to
podcast.
Get in touch with him.
Yeah. Yeah. I can set that up where you can get in touch with him.
That would be awesome.
Jake's fantastic. He was there at the invasion, and he's in Safe House with me. He's a fantastic guy.
Safe House was a really good movie.
I love his story. You know, he's so loves this country and was so inspired, like you, and wanted to, you know, get in there and do his part. And, you know, now he's living his life and he's having a very successful acting career. He's a fantastic guy. You should really meet him.
That's great.
But I love hearing those stories. And then to be given the position to utilize what celebrity I have to be a part of the USO and go and see the troops and let them see the
T-1000. It changes perspective. Yeah. I mean, and that's kind of like where we were going, where he's talking about, you know, the weirdness of the political climate in Hollywood. Well, it's like, you see some of the people with the biggest opinions against some of the things that we do, but they've never been over there. And yeah. They don't know what it looks like
right. Away
from the safe place that they get to just drive around freely, not worry about, you know, having their car stolen or them killed or anything like that.
That
like,
is the great
you
thing.
Went over there more than what, 8 times?
I think we're in the double digits.
Yeah,
now.
And you've seen what it looks like.
I've seen it from like 2000, 2006. I've seen the big buildup. I'm amazed at the logistics of putting together that infrastructure to go to battle. I've heard the commanders talk. I've seen you guys and get your experience, what it's like on the ground. It's an amazing thing to see. What a privilege I have as an American citizen to go there and see and witness what a big buildup is like. And the great thing about the USO is the fact that we can do that and then come back home and tell people about our wonderful men and women of the armed forces and the great job they're doing for us and how fantastic they are and how they need our support. And it's 1% of our population doing this for the rest of us, which is astounding. And I just did Najimi, Niger. I went down to AFP 101. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know.
You went there with the USO?
Yeah.
So that's a special forces or special
it's
operations.
It's total special forces, special operations base. What a unique thing. But, you know, the country is kind of a shithole. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
They've got uranium. So that's one of the reasons we're down there, to kind of keep an eye on what's going on. But to meet those guys and see what they're enduring. That's where that...
You probably met a couple of my buddies.
I bet you I did. Great guys. They had that ambush at Tonga Tonga.
Yes.
That was that... unit was out.
Yeah,
of that
so
base.
we last May, we picked up and went to Fort Bragg and did a fundraiser for those guys that were killed in that ambush.
That's beautiful. When we're at the conclusion of this, I'll show you on my phone. I got some pictures of a memorial, and I've got some things I'll show you from that trip. But to be able to do that and then come back and tell people, it's a great thing about the USO. It's very unique, United Servicemen's Organization.
You're one of the few celebrities who works with a lot of, you know, veterans. You ever met like Gary Sinise?
Oh, Gary's a buddy. Yeah. No, Gary's a buddy. He's actually kind of a role model for me because
he does amazing things for our community.
Selfless giving that he has. I mean, he's set the bar so high at what he does, raising money for veterans and helping and. He's just an amazing guy, really, to look up to. I'm very inspired by him. Great thing I got to do was fill in for him at the PBS Memorial Day concert. His granddaughter was being born. I got a call. I was doing a movie in Georgia. And he said, Robert, there's only one guy I can think that could fill my shoes to do this. You're the guy. I need you to go fill in for me at the Memorial Day thing. That was live on PBS. You know those things they do?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I got to go do that, and it felt good that he picked me to do it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's great. And he's done a lot of work with Rolling Thunder, too, back in the early days, the protest. And this year, by the way, is the last Rolling Thunder that's happening, which is the demonstration we do at the wall for the POW and MIA.
Why is this the last year?
I think everybody's just a little tired.
Yeah.
You know, I've been doing it for 30-some-odd years, just like my partner, Oliver Shoku, had the largest single fundraising event in motorcycle history, which is the Love Ride. He's raised probably $25 million, maybe $30 million in the 30-some-odd years that he's been doing that event. I think at a certain point you just kind of get tired. It takes a lot to focus and to pull that off, the logistics of setting something like that up. And I think these guys are just – there's talk that it might be more satellite Rolling Thunders around the country, which would be exciting.
Yeah.
So, but it's a big event for Harley-Davidson people. You know, one of the reasons why I own a Harley-Davidson dealership is because of the freedom I get from riding this vehicle across the country and experiencing the country. And I can't tell you the number of Iraqi guys that I met, the vets that I've met. I've met them on base, and I've said, while you're here fighting for my freedom, I want you to know when I go back to California, I'll be riding across this fucking country, and I owe it all to you. And I can't thank you enough for giving me and protecting my freedom to allow me to enjoy this country that way. And this brand in particular, to me, signifies America more than any other brand that I can think of.
Well, it's certainly one of the most iconic. And I would have to imagine for somebody like you who does, you know, long shoots, there's nothing more relaxing than just checking out, turning off the cell phone, and then just going for a ride. Because right now, I feel like we're followed by cameras and everything else all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, this owning a Harley is one of those things where you're like, man,
well,
you can really just check out of the world.
And you can check out. You get on there. You put your full face mask helmet on, and I'm totally anonymous. It's me in the road.
Yep.
Me and my thoughts. Me and my God. You know. Me, and my buddies riding across this beautiful country. And no matter how many times you ride across it, and I've done it 10 or 11 times now.
Yeah.
You're still blown away by the beauty of this country. You're just amazed. And then the other thing, when you get outside of L.A. and New York and you get out there and you meet the people,
mm-hmm.
you're blown away by how nice they are.
Yeah.
How interested they are. I can't tell you, you ride in on a Harley, you park at a gas station. Everybody wants to come up and talk to you. Where are you from? Wow, you're from California? Holy Toledo, you rode all the way across here on that bike? One of the most fun times I ever had riding, I'd just done a USO tour with Tim Kennedy.
Yeah.
My buddy Tim.
Tim's a good friend, yeah.
Timmy is, I love him. And we did a USO tour together. Matthew Lillard was with us. Tim's big saying was, fuck ISIS. Fuck ISIS.
We have a song called that.
Yeah,
fuck ISIS. So I came back, and I come back from this USO trip. I'm riding across country with my good friend New York Mike, who owns San Diego Harley Davidson, and he's a Vietnam vet. We're going back for Rolling Thunder. He was a Ford Air controller. He's Air Force guy, Vietnam.
What's his name?
Mike Shelby, New York Mike. He owns San Diego Harley. You should really meet with him.
I was a Ford Air controller.
Yeah.
I should meet with him.
You should meet him. You would love him. He's a badass. And we're riding across country. We're in Kansas, I believe. And he was on the phone dealing with something. And I went into this. It was like a little hardware kind of little store in there. And I got some boat ID tape numbers, letters.
Yeah.
And on my saddlebag, on my left one, in white, I had a black bike in about... What is that, 6 inches?
Yeah.
Maybe. Size letters, it said, fuck. And on the other said, ISIS. I rode all the way across the country with this thing. I had people coming up next to me. Yeah, I am barreling down the road. Coming up. Yeah, fuck. I had a cop pull me over just to say, who's this crazy guy riding around with fuck ISIS on the back of his bike? Rode all the way, got to Washington, D.C. All the Harley guys were out there getting their pictures with it, looking at that. They were having a ball with that thing. The more fun for me was when I rode into Vermont and saw my daughter at her liberal arts school. I rode onto campus with the fuck ISIS thing. The college students were all going like, pretty much says it all right there, sir. Pretty much sums it up right there, buddy.
That is the best.
Yeah.
That's fun stuff. Tim Kennedy.
Tim
great
Kennedy.
Guy.
Oh,
great
Tim,
guy.
Yeah. You see a
I
couple
days. I watched his last fight at Sylvester Stallone's house.
No,
oh, really?
Yeah, kidding.
That last fight he had.
Was Stallone watching it with you?
Yeah, we were cigars sitting there watching it.
Yeah, we had him on the show right afterwards, right after he lost, and
that was tough for him.
Well, the problem was he was supposed to fight on that McGregor card,
yeah,
and then he had cut all this weight, and then we're like, I think the guy got injured or tested
something happened.
Yeah, tested positive, so they said, hey, we'll put you on the next card. Well, the problem is trying to cut that weight twice. He said on the show, he was like, man, I was exhausted.
He works out. That guy is. Like one of the hardest working out guys I've ever seen in my life.
He lives that life.
Well, did you see 2 days ago somebody tried to break into his house?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was that?
That was real.
What the fuck?
You fucked up.
Oh, man. Could you imagine breaking into Tim Kennedy's house for Christ's sakes?
Well, of all the houses in the world.
You just why broke would you... into a Special Forces sniper UFC fighter's I mean, house.
You couldn't have picked the worst house.
No.
Who is this guy? That's the definition of an idiot.
Yeah. When I saw
we need
his...
to give him an award. We need to find this
you
dude's identity.
Yeah.
He is the dumbest person in the United States.
I want to know what happened to him. I don't know what Tim did.
What do you think he did?
No, I know, but I'm sure there's...
He just said it. You picked the wrong house.
Yeah.
What did he say? It was a I follow his Instagram.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Play stupid games.
Yeah.
Stupid
yeah. On a prizes. Photo of him with yeah. his pistol drawn and the light on the guy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't miss.
No.
Oh, he's not going to miss.
No. I mean, he teaches
Kennedy
courses,
was on,
for Christ's sakes.
He does.
Was on 7 Special Forces Group's SIF company. And, you know, Tim's a shooter.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. He sent me a box of that Ranger Up gear he's got.
Yeah.
Ah, it's great
Yeah,
stuff.
His company, yeah.
It's great stuff. It's
yeah,
great
so
stuff.
We work with him on Range 15, and, yeah, great guy.
He's down in Texas with you guys.
He's in Austin.
Yeah, he's in Austin.
Yeah, he's in Austin. Yeah. I was just down there for South by Southwest. I didn't have time to look him up, but I had a movie,
you have a movie
that
movie
was
there?
Premiering down there. Yeah, I have a movie that's coming out. You guys will like this movie. It's called Tone Deaf. It is a movie, a generational movie, a political horror comedy, dark, about a baby boomer generation widower who opens up his mansion to as an Airbnb to a millennial because he's never, he didn't go off to war. He didn't serve in Vietnam. So he's kind of got this psychotic itch where he kind of wants to know what it's like to kill somebody. And he decides...
Well, you're talking to the right guy here.
He might as well go after one of these millennials because they disgust him. And it's so this generational thing, this baby boomer point of view and this millennial point
what
of view.
What a dark
clash
movie.
Of generation. It's pretty funny. It's very dark. And I won't screw up the ending, but it was pretty well received at South by Southwest. So... I'm excited about that. I think it comes out in August. It's called Tone Deaf.
Okay.
And it's myself and Amanda Crew from Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Is in it. Ricky Bates Jr. directed it.
That's great.
That's neat.
Awesome. Who are some of your favorites that you've worked with throughout your career?
Oh, my God. Well, you mentioned some of them. Bruce and Arnold and James Cameron.
Harrison
Ford. You were
talking about Stallone.
Stallone I've worked with twice. I love Sly. Great guy.
Hey.
I did Copland with him.
Yeah.
And
Copland's one, and another one.
What a great movie.
I was so
Harvey
pissed
Keitel.
When he didn't win an Oscar, by the way.
Yeah.
God damn it, man. That was 2 years ago, and I was just like, just give it to
yeah,
him.
Yeah, Creed.
At this point, just give it to him.
Well, he was really great in that movie, too.
He was fantastic in it.
Harrison Ford.
That's a buddy of yours?
Wow.
I did a movie with Harrison. He's a fantastic guy. I had a wonderful dinner with Harrison. Very, very cool guy. Just he and I having a
he gets
nice
high.
Meal.
He likes to smoke a lot of weed.
Well, no comment. I'm not gonna do that. I got a microphone in my hand.
No worries. It's a known thing.
He does what he does. He's also a pilot. You know, he flies and does also. He's a cool guy.
Yeah.
Loved working. I've done 2 movies with Clint Eastwood.
Oh wow!
You know, he's a big hero of mine.
Yeah.
And one where he was the director, which was Flags of Our Fathers.
Yep.
Based on that book.
Oh, yeah.
Great film,
The Invasion of Iwo Jima. And the other was Trouble with the Curve, where I got to be his boss.
Was that... That was a baseball movie. Was it Justin Timberlake who was in that?
It was.
Yeah.
And Amy Adams.
Yeah.
And Matthew Lillard. And Matthew Lillard... Who, do you know Matthew?
Yeah, I do, yeah. He almost ended up doing one of my films maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Great guy. I mean, couldn't have been nicer. It was a scheduling conflict. He went out of his way to call me, and it was just a great dude all the way around.
Yeah, he's a sweet guy. He's a guy, one of these Hollywood guys, where I popped into a USO, I popped into a van to go off on a shoot for Trouble with the Curve. And he was sitting, and he noticed the USO luggage tag on my backpack. He said, the USO? He said, what do you do with the USO? And I said, well, you know, I go over when they give me an opportunity to see the troops. And I've been here and here and here and here, and then I come back and tell everybody about how fantastic our armed forces are. I would really like to do that. Now, I've heard that before from people, you know, and I never hear from them again.
Right.
Or when they really find out what they got to do it, because it's not an easy thing. You got to fly for 24, 36 hours, get there, and then you're running around. You're not getting a lot of sleep. It's a big deal. It's an investment of time. And Matthew was one of the few that said, I volunteer to go, and I want to go. Can you set me up? And I said, sure. And I've done, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 with him.
Yeah. Anybody that's done it, like you have to want to do it, because it's not easy.
It's not easy.
You're flying coach. To Kuwait,
yeah,
and then you're getting on a military bird, and it's, you're rolling in. And I mean, we did one a couple years ago. I mean, we do 24 hours of flying, and we step out, and they're like, "You're going on in 1 hour."
Yeah,
and they're like, "Oh,
yeah,
all right,
wow, coffee,
yeah,
anybody, Monster."
And if you haven't seen Jerry without alcohol, it's a nightmare. Oh, it's a, no, I'm kidding. Because they don't have that over there, right?
Well, I don't know. No. Well, not in Kuwait.
No.
Yeah, not in Kuwait. Yeah,
dry
not
country.
In Kuwait, not in Kuwait. But it's. But he took me up on it, and Matt and I have done quite a few. He's my road dog.
That's
awesome. Very great American.
That's awesome. What do you have coming down the pipe as far as film-wise goes? I know you say you've got the film at South by Southwest. I feel like you're always doing television. I've seen you in a lot of TV. A
lot of TV. First,
Mayans MC, I believe.
Mayans,
I just
saw
you on.
I did the pilot.
Did you meet our buddy Rocco? Vince Vargas?
Yes, absolutely. Great guy. I had done Sons of Anarchy, and they asked me to come in and represent Sons of Anarchy for the Mayans pilot.
That was awesome.
Kurt Sutter's become a friend, you know, from the whole motorcycle world thing. I've got like 5 or 6 movies coming out down the pike, so I've been real busy. I think the last one I did was in December. And so far this year, I've just been focused on this dealership and getting this thing up and running really well.
Sure.
Being somewhat selective over what my next move is going to be. I'm not sure if I want to go back into television. I just did 4 years on the TV show for CBS called Scorpion.
It's a grind, isn't it? That TV schedule, that 1 hour drama.
Hard.
Yeah.
It's very, very, again, it's not digging ditches, but it is grueling in its own way. And I'm just not sure what I want to do. So being a little super selective right now, I've been afforded the opportunity to be a little bit more. So.
You see yourself working till like 88, like Clint Eastwood? I mean, that guy is still grinding out movies at 88.
And like Clint, I want to be inspired to direct a film. Like my buddy Max Martini would love to be able to go and direct a film like Max has done. Kudos to Max for Sergeant Will Gardner and pulling that off. He wrote that.
Yeah.
He wrote it and directed it.
Went out for financing and all that stuff, because
he's on just the financing. He's got two more, I think.
He's got two more going. Yeah, he's doing really, really well. But, you know, Bobby Duvall, I did a movie with Bobby, and he's a big inspiration to me. He played my father in Jay Mansfield's Car. But, you know, as far as longevity and working forever and ever and ever and doing, you know, really good work, and those guys inspire me. So, yes. Joke in my family is you know, either I'm either going to die on my mark or, you know, be in my trailer and some poor little PA is going to come knock on the door and find me dead in there. He's dead. I don't know what happened. I served him breakfast. He was fine.
He was fine, and then he's dead.
Oh, God.
This is the point in the show where we get to the drinking bro of the week.
Drinking bro.
Of the week. This is somebody that has inspired you or helped you or just kind of molded you into the man or actor that you are today. Is there one person in your life?
I'm going to give my drinking bro to one of my best friends, Stephen Bridgewater, who has also been kind of a mentor to me, if I've ever had one. He's my acting coach. And I started working with him. The first job I did with him was The Sopranos.
Oh, wow.
And it was a life-changing thing for me. And he really helped me with my confidence with acting and turned my career around. And I think I would definitely say my acting coach, Stephen Bridgewater.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
And I don't know where he... I think he's in Nashville, Tennessee right now, working with his daughter, Jessie, who has horses in Nashville. I think he's... Stephen is... he's still in Hollywood, but, you know, Hollywood, it's a tough place to be. So I think he's in Nashville for about a year.
Yeah.
But he's been the biggest influence on me career-wise.
That's great.
So if, and he still drinks. If I was drinking, Stephen, if you hear this, we'd definitely pound down some, brother. I've been sober 23 years.
Have you really?
Impressive.
Yeah.
That's impressive. That's amazing. I think he's done it for maybe 40 days.
23 days. You know.
Yeah.
Well, you
recently,
know, I mean,
recently
it
quit
works for some
and...
people, and I bring it up just because, you know, I don't like the whole anonymity of it for myself. I mean, I am proud of it. It's a major accomplishment to be able to go 23 years without having a drink.
Sure.
I did it for my kids. I didn't want my kids to see me fucked up. And my daughter's birthday today, she's 22. She's never seen me fucked up. And it was important to me. That was the main, that was the impetus for me giving up. Plus, I was a terrible drunk and got arrested for it. And, you know,
yeah.
Stupid shit.
Yeah.
I can't drink. Yeah. I had to admit, I can't do it.
Yeah, so. But there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, shit, you corrected
it. If you can,
it.
You yeah. can. If you can't, you can't.
Yeah, exactly.
You did the best thing you could do.
Yeah, you go. So
you did.
I'm very, very happy with my sobriety. But, Stephen, if I was going to have one right now, buddy, it'd be with you.
Tell all the people at home where your dealership is, where they can find you.
Well, I hope everybody that's listening to this thing hasn't been too bored with this podcast.
No, you're...
I hope I'm keeping you entertained.
You're one of the most fascinating awesome. Dudes on the planet. Yeah.
I appreciate it. You're yeah. being very kind. My dealership is... it's the new Harley-Davidson dealership of Santa Clarita, California, which is approximately 30 miles from my house in the Hollywood Hills. It's just north of Los Angeles. It's right off the 14 and the 5. I'll give you the address. What is it? 21160 Center Point Parkway.
Yeah.
And there's a Drinking Bros special for Harleys out
yeah,
there.
20%
right?
Yeah, 20% off Drinking Bros promo code on every bike.
Yeah. We're going to have some cool stuff up here. We're going to have a T-shirt that's going to be exclusive to this dealership only. We're thinking about bringing back the Love Ride. We've done the Love Ride for the USO before. We've done the Love Ride for Wounded Warriors. We might do some stuff with Gary Sinise up here. I'm gonna try to get Gary over here with Lieutenant Dan Ban. This might be the first he's hearing of it right here. but we're gonna you know, we really want to. This community is adventure minded, and power sports. They have power sports tendencies. There's a lot of testosterone up in this community in Santa Clarita. We're excited to really give them the dealership that they deserve. So we're in the works right now of making it as beautiful as we can for them and a place that they're going to want to come hang out and buy a Harley-Davidson, the best motorcycle in the world. You can come in here and get some free coffee and take a free test ride. I love it. I love the fact that I'm in business with Harley-Davidson to have the opportunity to sell freedom, which is what America is.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm basically selling America.
Yeah.
So I'm super proud that I'm in the to have Oliver Shoku invite me to be his partner and be here. And when we have the Love Ride, when we ever do get it back here, I'd love to have the Drinking Bros here. Anytime you guys want to use this place to do a podcast, you want to bring in another guest from outside, seriously.
That'd be fantastic.
When
absolutely.
You're in L.A., if you're looking for a location and... You don't have to interview me every time. You can bring somebody in, bring Max Martini in, whoever you
yeah,
want.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
would be a great spot for
we
that.
Would love oh, to, absolutely. We would love to extend our invitation to you.
Thank
to,
you.
To
hey,
come
thank you.
Be
this
here.
Was awesome.
Thank you so much. And Drinking Bros, come on out.
Center Point Parkway.
There it is.
Santa
they got
Clarita,
it.
California.
They got it.
What's the zip code? 9-1-3-5-0 There you go.
There we go. Come on down.
Come on down.
Robert Patrick, one of the finest actors we have.
You're so, what a wonderful
just compliment. You're just a cool motherfucker.
Yes. Appreciate
just
that,
cool
guys.
Motherfucker, man.
Hey, gunny time. I'm going out to Cayman, Arizona to shoot two more episodes of Gunny Time.
Are you
know
you?
That
oh,
show?
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know that show R. Lee Ermey did?
Yeah.
For Glock?
Yeah.
I'm going out to Cayman, Arizona. Oh. I'm going to be shooting. I'm going to ride my Harley out there. Going to be shooting Glocks.
That's perfect.
Oh, that's awesome.
Come on out. Have you guys ever been to the big Sandy?
No, I've never been. Have you?
I'm going to be shooting some stuff that they had to see my passport to let me shoot this. I'm going to be there with Randy Couture.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh, Randy was in Range 15 as well, yeah.
Adam Baldwin.
Yeah.
From Full Metal Jacket and myself. We're going to be out there shooting Gunny Time episodes.
That's awesome.
We did it last year. We got them running up here on the TVs up here, but super excited about that.
That's amazing. Oh. Robert, thank you again, man.
God bless you guys. What a pleasure.
Yeah, really amazing, pleasure. Robert. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.